Welcome to Education, Technology, Society, a podcast about education in the digital age.
Welcome to Education, Technology, Society, a podcast about education in the digital age.
Hello and welcome to Education, Technology, Society. This is a podcast where we think about all things to do with digital education and ed tech, but from a slightly more critical perspective than is usually the case. My name is Neil Selwyn from Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. And today I'm talking with Faith Boniger from the National Education Policy Centre in Colorado. Now, along with Alex Molnar and lots of others in NEPC, Faith's involved in a bunch of different projects, monitoring and advocating against commercialism in education. Now, commercialism in education can take a heap of different forms, but it's increasingly involving education technology, including things like virtual high schools, personalised learning systems, digital surveillance, and all sorts of other familiar ed tech industry solutions. So it's great to get a critical policy lens in all of this. So I caught up with Faith to hear about everything that NEPC has been doing in the digital space. It's a really valuable addition to the work that we all do. I hope you enjoy. Just for the uninitiated, what is the National Education Policy Centre and what are your driving kind of principles and concerns about education? What are you about?
So the National Education Policy Center is a research center out of the School of Education at the University of Colorado. And our reason for being is to enhance the democratic deliberation of education policy issues. And to that end, we publish policy briefs, we publish original research briefs, and we've got a network of fellows around the country that help us in our endeavors. We're a small shop of people who are the employees of NEPC, but we've got a wide network around the country of fellows that we call on for all kinds of help and advice.
And so this idea of democratic deliberation around ed tech is not two concepts you ever really hear put together. I mean, ed tech is often the least democratic and the least deliberative. So a lot of your work, I've noticed, is based around kind of digital issues in education. And I'm just really interested, I mean, what forms of digital education have you found to be kind of really worth working on? And how do they kind of correspond with what you just said about making policy better, making policy more democratic?
You're right that EdTech tends to be not democratic, which is probably why it's important to write about it, to bring it to policymakers' attention so that there can hopefully be quality policy about it. And unfortunately, that has been lacking. So we've had a project for many years looking at full-time virtual schools. That's a project that Alex Molnar has led with Gary Muran, John Luis Huerta, Jennifer King Rice. That's been a group effort over the years to follow the phenomenon, the development of full-time virtual schools. And then Alex and I direct a section of NEPC, that's the Commercialism in Education Research Unit. And well, he started, and then I came in the early 2000s, but we've been following how companies get at children in schools and market to children in schools. And ed tech kind of came out of that. Our interest in ed tech came from there because Alex had a long, long time ago paid attention to electronic marketing to kids in schools. And then we were writing a book in 2014 and we were looking at stuff and we were noticing all this stuff on privacy and bills coming up having to do with the privacy of kids' data with exceptions for personalized learning. And we thought, what's with all of these exceptions for personalized learning?
Yeah.
And so that got us into looking at that component.
I mean, as you say, there's heaps going on, and there has been for years, ever since Channel One in schools. But I mean, the digital is particularly different. And this idea of full-time virtual high schools, I think, is fascinating. So to the uninitiated, I mean, what is the virtual school landscape in the States at the moment?
Well, it's a small percentage of the students, but it's a fairly decent number. And the thing is that it's been growing, right, since Alex and Gary and those guys have been looking at it. So pulled up some numbers. In 2019-20, there were just over 332,000 students enrolled. 2021, that jumped to almost 645,000, which is a really big jump. And that decreased some in 2021-22, so it's more like 575, a little more than that. But, you know, it's a pretty significant increase over the years. And then in terms of the numbers of schools, there were 477 in 1920. There were 653 in 2021 and 726 in 21-22. So it's a growing sector. And the thing about it is that there are some of these full-time virtual schools that are run by districts, but very many of them are run by education management organizations. They're run as charter schools, and there's just not enough attention in terms of policy to these schools, ensuring that there are inequality.
Yeah, absolutely. And what sort of students actually are going to these charter schools?
Well, I mean, theoretically, it could be anybody, but they tend to serve less minority populations.
Yeah, I mean, looking from the outside, you always get the idea there's a kind of a second chance school system or a kind of sink school system where students kind of get pushed towards rather than there's a push rather than the pull factor.
Yeah. So it's something that's been worth paying attention to because it's been growing, because it just needs attention in terms of the quality.
So what do you find when you pay attention? What do you find about these virtual charter schools, particularly in terms of equity?
They're big. The student-teacher ratio is, I don't know if you say high or low, whatever. It's not good compared to the district-run schools and compared to the national averages. Their performance is awful in terms of being evaluated. First of all, there isn't good regulation around it, so you can't always get performance data. But where you can get it, you see that their performance is poor. The graduation rate is much worse than the national average.
Yeah.
It's, I think, really an issue of the education management organizations running these schools where they're just huge and huge, big classes. Students aren't getting the attention. And the fact that when it's digital, you can have a teacher assigned to a whole bunch of kids and have the kids doing it, you know, asynchronously. You can basically make the parent the teaching assistant. It becomes very often the case that parents are responsible for the child doing their work and then interpreting and, you know, all that kind of thing. And if the parent isn't available, isn't able, then the child's at a loss.
So I guess one of the kind of main reasons for you doing this work is to come up with policy recommendations. So, I mean, in an ideal world, how would you see virtual schools actually kind of fitting into the general education landscape? What would you like to see?
Would like to see policy that focuses on accountability, you know, oversight and accountability, making sure that they're working in an appropriate manner and educating students the way that ought to be done, as opposed to just, you know, a wild west where they get to do whatever they want.
Yep, that's all you can do. And moving on to the second, I mean, you mentioned personalized learning. That has been a bete noir of NEPC over the years. And again, before we get into the weeds, what sort of personalized learning systems and kind of levels of use are you noticing in the US? What are we talking about here? And also, I mean, what are the problems that you're seeing with what you find?
You know, it's interesting, your use of the term bete noir, because, you know, in reality, it's just one observation led to another, you know. But it seems there was such a push, you know, led by the Gates Foundation. And when we started to see that personalized learning was exempt from privacy regulation, you know, we started looking at it to see, well, you know, what's going on here? You know, what kind of data is being collected? How does this happen? What do the contracts look like? And we chose Summit Learning, Summit Public Schools, just as an example to see what we would learn about personalized learning. And we didn't get anywhere with that. We ended up, when we didn't get a response, we ended up doing a Freedom of Information Act request. And I really started digging into the contracts that I was able to access and see there what was going on in terms of data and what the contracts allowed in terms of data collection, how they changed over the years to allow more free use of student data and continual maintenance of the de-identified data that computer scientists have known isn't really de-identified, like, forever. And Summit was a concrete example for us to just see how this worked. That was interesting because it was a full digital personalized learning system, right, that schools would adopt whole hog, right, that would replace their, you know, whatever they were doing before. But I think more common at this point is kind of piecemeal personalized learning.
Well, I was going to ask you actually, because nearly 10 years have passed since the first kind of Summit first hit the headlines. Mm-hmm. And there were the protests in particular towns and student walkouts and the rest of it. I mean, looking back 10 years, how has it actually worked out in schools? I mean, has Summit and personalized learning been normalized in today's schooling? Has it kind of faded away to the margins? Are people still angry about it?
I don't know that it's faded away, but it's faded some. So in 2014 and 15 is when Facebook got involved. And then in 2017, they kind of switched it over, passed it over to the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative to fund. And there was a lot of funding, hundreds of thousands of dollars that they were putting into it. And last year, they decided that they're not funding it anymore. So I think that's a really big change, you know, not having that support. So I think it is fading in that way.
Which, if you think about all of the kind of the harm that's been caused by this, all of the kind of the collateral damage. But I guess for the Silicon Valley mindset is you fail fast, fail often, you can pivot very quickly. We've seen plenty of things like this in terms of, you know, the big next thing that's going to revolutionize, and then all of a sudden it disappears. But there are real children's lives and families that have been affected by this. I mean, is this going to be just a cycle that we repeat endlessly throughout the decades?
You know, it seems like, I mean, you know, that's what Alex originally noticed when he started researching commercialism in schools, and that companies will come in with a lot of fanfare about what they're providing to schools, but then if it stops serving their bottom line, then they pull out. You know, they could pivot. It's really easy for them to pivot, but what do you do if you're the school and the kids and the families that are pivoted on? Hmm. That's a problem. And you know, that's something that we saw with Summit, where they decided to close schools. So, I mean, those families were devastated because this was their center and they loved the schools. And all of a sudden it was like, nope, sorry, done.
Yeah, which, I mean, you and I know how unprofitable education can be. So you kind of want to just tell these firms not to bother, go somewhere else and disrupt another sector. Public education is too important.
Disrupt something else, somebody else. Yeah. But, you know, there's a certain like messianic tech perspective, I think, sometimes. I have a friend who used to be in tech and he was really interested in education and honestly thought that it was the way to go. And he and I would spar, you know, and then after a long time, he's like, you know, yeah, I don't think this is going to work.
Yeah, it's quite difficult, they find. They always find education's more tricky than they imagined. Well, I mean, just to wrap up, we've talked about virtual schools and personalized learning, but I mean, your organization and you as an academic, you're interested in all sorts of stuff, you know, marketing, corporate control, surveillance. There's a lot of it actually where ed tech comes together with these things. Are there any trends or emerging developments in ed tech that now particularly are concerning you, you know, over the next few years? What's coming next to be worried about?
You've heard of AI?
Yeah, it's kind of quite big over here.
You know, we've been thinking a lot together about AI and the implications. And I mean, it magnifies the problems that we've all been seeing with ed tech, right? Because it's more opaque, right? And it's more out of control of teachers' hands. It opens up even more issues. So that's the thing that I personally am concerned about looking forward. But then, you know, in the U.S. context, there's a real concern about privatization. And, you know, we can look at ed tech as sort of a stealth privatization. But there's the other component going on in the U.S. having to do with vouchers, that there's a real big push for universal vouchers in the U.S. So public education is in a difficult spot. You know, so that's the kind of things that we're looking at.
Yeah, and how those logics bump up against, you know, tech nonsense around blockchain and God knows whatever else, you can kind of see that there's a tech solution for vouchers 2.0. And then, yeah, it's a scary thought. But I mean, I'm always trying to be hopeful. So let's not think the world is going to go to hell in a handcuff. Well, thanks ever so much for taking the time, Faith, for talking about it. It's always really good work. And I love the reports when they come out every year, because they actually give some empirical evidence to some of the stuff that we all suspect. So I hope you can continue doing it for years to come. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot. It's great talking to you.